Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 21st episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we finish Act 3, Scene 1 with the shocking and potentially violent nunnery scene. Will your sympathies remain with Hamlet after this? The last section of Act 3, Scene 1, is Hamlet's stage encounter with Ophelia, in which he may or may not discover that he's being spied upon by Claudius and Polonius, who close out the scene after Hamlet leaves, with important consequences for the prince. We'll look at how different directors staged this sequence and how different actors played it, but first let's look at the text itself. The conversation starts with Ophelia. "Good my lord, how does your honor for this many a day?" And Hamlet answers, "I humbly thank you, well, well, well." And I love Hamlet's triple repetitions because the actors can play around with them so much. As with the previous words, 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 and accept my life, actors can take each instance and give it its own reading, or find a way to say all three with the same intent. Ophelia: "My lord, I have remembrances of yours that I have long and longed to re-deliver. I pray you now receive them." There's something quite touching about the use of the word remembrances here. Ophelia is not just returning tokens or gifts, but the memories associated with those objects. Memory plays a big part in this section of the text, as Hamlet then makes like he doesn't remember having given her anything. Hamlet's demeanor has changed, and he has, in effect, become someone else, changing the meaning of Ophelia's memories. There's no doubt an interesting thesis could be extracted from how people's perceptions of one another change, and in turn change their memories of one another throughout the play. There's the revelation that Claudius is a murderer, of course, which is made to both Hamlet and later Gertrude. False friends revealed, lovers lost, princes mistrusted, Norway's intentions as well, and ultimately Hamlet's own new understanding of himself. Hamlet goes on the offensive after this, and both impugns Ophelia's honesty and cruelly denies he ever loved her. Hamlet's harshness may be born of a mirroring effect, though Ophelia is betraying his trust here, playing a part in her father's scheme. It's not clear whether Hamlet knows about it or not. So why so harsh? If he knows about the spies, it could all be a part of the act, a tug of war between what he really feels and the act he's putting on for Claudius and Polonius. His cruelty towards Ophelia is to Hamlet a necessary evil. However, if he doesn't know he's being spied upon, at least until he asks where her father is, it may be more true to say that he's actually talking to his mother. Ophelia did not betray him, but Gertrude did betray his father. Hamlet indicts the entire sex in a run of willful misogyny. Women, being attractive to men as they are, make men lose their reason and betray themselves, according to Hamlet. The solution he proposes is to lock away women before they cause more men to do so. And so, get thee to a nunnery, why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners? In these lines, Hamlet blames his mother, not just for betraying his father, but for his own birth. Motivated by present circumstances and Oedipal impulse, though you know how I hate the Freudian interpretation of the play, or his religious beliefs, Hamlet has put all the sins of the world on his mother. His father is dead because Claudius killed him to get her. He must now avenge his father, which is a tragedy because he exists thanks to his mother. In this sequence, Shakespeare reveals that at least part of the reason Hamlet has been delaying action is that he's been moved to take revenge on the wrong person. Claudius is at fault, sure, and Hamlet hates him. However, the ghost's warning not to hurt Gertrude is what rankles, and it all comes out in Hamlet's treatment of Ophelia in this scene. We should also mention that nunnery is an ironic term for a whorehouse. Just as in an earlier scene, Hamlet called Polonius a fishmonger, a colloquialism that can mean pimp, Hamlet can again be seen as treating Ophelia or Gertrude or women as whores. Nun or whore, according to Hamlet, neither is meant to be a mother. The line also holds a few actorly double entendres, from the concepts of imagination and acting out offenses to the request not to believe the actor's words. It plays on multiple levels, since the actors on stage are not really their characters, and Hamlet is play-acting his madness, though that's still ambiguous. The tirade ends on the question, "Where is your father?" Shakespeare doesn't give many stage directions. They're suggested by the text itself. Ophelia's invocation to God in response indicates Hamlet is acting strangely, losing himself in madness. His words don't really suggest it, so it's up to the director and actors to figure it out. We'll see how different adaptations deal with it. Before he leaves, Hamlet goes into one last litany. "I have heard of your paintings too well enough. God has given you one face, and you make yourselves another. You jig, you amble, and you lisp, and nickname God's creatures, and make your wantonness your ignorance. Go to, I'll no more aunt, it hath made me mad. I say we will have no more marriages. Those that are married already, all but one shall live. The rest shall keep as they are." To a nunnery go. I love the line, "the rest shall keep as they are." A fabulously clever continuation of the rotting theme of the play. Those that are married already are Gertrude and Claudius. One shall live, Gertrude, and the other shall keep as he is, Claudius. Not die, but keep. The idea is that he's dead and rotting already. An image of corruption or a fate that can no longer be delayed. Note that the other married man in the play is Hamlet Sr., another character that is kept as he is, preserved by the special state of the undead. Hamlet once again puts a mirror up to the two kings, and in this case, finds them equivalent. On the surface, it also refers to marriage. Of those who are married, one shall live, and the others will remain married or unmarried, whatever the case may be. In other words, Hamlet won't marry Ophelia. Ophelia gets a short speech here.
"Oh, what a noble mind is here on a throne. The courtiers, soldiers, scholars. Eye, tongue, sword, the expectancy and rose of the fair state, the glass of fashion and the mould of form, the observed of all observers. Quite, damn. And I, of ladies most inject and wretched, that suck the honey of his music vows, now see that noble and most sovereign reason, like sweet bells jangled out of tune and harsh, that unmatched form and feature of blown youth, blasted with ecstasy. Oh, woe is me to have seen what I have seen. See what I see."
This little soliloquy paints a portrait of Hamlet before he went mad, at least through her eyes. Even after all this, she's not stopped loving him. The perfume has not been lost, we could say. Note how Ophelia feels sorry for herself for having a particular experience, again, a play on memory. If ignorance is bliss, then Ophelia would have rather stayed ignorant. I don't think I've ever come across it, but a director could theoretically use the past tense on that last line to involve Ophelia in the murder of Hamlet Sr. What she sees now is Hamlet's madness. What she has seen in the past could be a secret she's keeping from Hamlet even now. The cause and not just the result of his madness. Just more reasons for her mind to break. Re-enter Claudius and Polonius. The king is convinced Hamlet's madness does not stem from love after all and decides to send him to England. Another mirror. If Hamlet cannot harm Gertrude for his father's sake, then Claudius cannot touch Hamlet for his wife's sake. Both men are prevented from taking the action they want by love for another. Claudius chooses exile for Hamlet, though that will soon change. And still, Polonius is adamant. Neglected love is at fault. He basically seals his own fate here. The way his particular hubris manifests is in his stubbornness that prevents him from accepting he's wrong, even though the play shows he almost invariably is. Claudius is convinced Hamlet is neither mad nor acting from neglected love. Polonius still disagrees and sets up yet another encounter, this time between Hamlet and his mother, during which Hamlet should admit to being mad for love. And it is spying on this encounter, of his own making, that gets him killed. A deft director could also use Polonius always being wrong to stage the sequence so they don't hear it all, like he says. Perhaps by making some of the lines whispers. Perhaps that's why Claudius hears no love in the exchange. It's also a good time to mention here the pregnancy theory, because none of the adaptations that we examine on Hyperion to a Satyr make use of this idea that Ophelia is perhaps pregnant. But if someone were to do so, this is where the most irony could be drawn from the idea. Ophelia would already be a breeder of sinners, and any injury, psychic or physical, would be all the more violent for it. If a nunnery is a whorehouse, that may be a clue that Hamlet and Ophelia have been sexually active, which plays into the pregnancy theory. Directors who entertain this notion may wish to reveal Ophelia's belly in her madness scenes, adding to the pathos, or have this particular sequence cause her to have a miscarriage, further motivating her madness. Now, initially, Branagh's Hamlet is all smiles and teary eyes, soft-spoken and kind, which in turn makes Kate Winslet's Ophelia hopeful and just as teary. The meeting is imbued with a tenderness we have not seen in Hamlet since the events of the play began. After Ophelia's, "How does your honor?" they both giggle at the formality, and he answers in kind, as if play-acting. We have to remember that in this adaptation, they've been intimate. So the courtly mannerisms are out of place, except that her father is watching, so Ophelia at least knows not to be too familiar. Hamlet's three wells are even more tender and end in an embrace.
Well. Well.
He holds her close, kisses her deeply, but she pushes him away to get things back on track. Hamlet appears deeply insulted, red-faced, and betrayed. And it's here that the staging seems to both ask and answer a question. Is Ophelia acting from a script? On the one hand, she's being particularly formal, and Hamlet might think, out of character. Then she fails to adapt to the situation, by which I mean Hamlet's surprise kindness, and reacts, perhaps as scripted, with a complete non sequitur, giving back Hamlet's gifts. Hamlet has just returned her affections, and now she's going on about perfume lost? But we would expect Polonius to have given Ophelia a script, right? She's a girl with no control over her life, and a poor improviser besides, so she pushes her father's agenda no matter what Hamlet says or does. There are other clues that point to this being the case. She looks to the side when, as if by rote, she says the line about rich gifts waxing poor, which really sounds like one of her father's slogans. Is she remembering, or is the eye motion a tell that points to the spies in the room? Does the prince react as he does because he realizes all this already, though the "where is your father" line is spoken only later? Or is it more visceral than that? An immediate connection between her apparent changeability and his mother's? It's a connection that certainly fuels his anger, since much of the coming speech and violence is transferred from guilty Gertrude to innocent Ophelia. And in terms of changeability, the pots and kettles irony is that Hamlet himself will turn unkind and confuse his would-be princess all the more. He slaps the gifts away, among them the poetry we know he wrote, and denies ever having given them to her. His moving, "I did love you once," sounds like he's imploring Ophelia not to go through with this charade.
"I did love you once."
He gives her an out and hopes she'll take it. And then the spies make a noise, and Ophelia lies about where her father is, with the guiltiest look in creation on her face. For Hamlet, it's the tipping point. He breaks down crying, hands on his face, and when Ophelia tries to reach out, he lashes out at her. Hamlet then drags Ophelia behind him as he opens one mirrored door after another in a rage-fueled game of hide-and-seek. He silences her and pushes her face against the door, and for the drama's sake, it's the exact door behind which Polonius and Claudius are hiding. It is telling that neither comes to Ophelia's defense. Though visibly shocked, seeing this through to the end is all they really care about, and they let Ophelia be violated, both physically and psychologically. She has been thoroughly abandoned. It's a violent image, one that distorts her face as a way of evoking her own mind snapping, and perhaps foreshadowing her drowning, the mirror providing a watery distortion. Hamlet guesses the spies are behind this door, or that they might move to that position during the assault, or can even hear them there at this range. We may assume that while his anger is genuine, he still puts on a show, using Ophelia as a prop. Violence gives way to a strange kiss when he tells her there will be no more marriages. Is he saying in this moment that they'll never be intimate again, marriage being equal to intercourse? And speaks straight at them, or at us, through the camera, when he threatens that all but one shall live. They run off before he can catch them, but it is clear they were there. Secret doors don't slam silently. He leaves Ophelia with one last kindness, now that they're gone, as his last to the nunnery go loses the tone that might connote a whorehouse.
To a nunnery go.
It's a plea for her to leave Elsinore before something bad happens, whether that be bloodletting or his own corruption. Ophelia's speech ends with a strange dawning realization, which I wish I had a good handle on. It remains one of this adaptation's mysteries for me, and considering how many times I've seen it, it's great to be able to admit that there are still some. See What I See has its own unique tone and makes us wonder just what it is she suddenly sees.
See what I see.
The rest of the speech makes her point of view rather naive. She believes Hamlet has gone mad. What is her epiphany at the end, then? Does she see the bigger picture, that perhaps Hamlet's troubles with women begin and end with his mother, that his madness is all for show, perhaps even having her suspect foul play in the death of the previous king and or the murder Hamlet is planning? Does she foresee her own doom, the only possible end for a dejected lady like her? Does she perhaps see her own guilt, since she continues to believe, like her father does, that she's the cause of Hamlet's madness, or simply for her duplicity in this particular scheme? Her face was just shoved into a mirror. What did she see of herself? Ambiguity reigns. The return of the other men is as traumatic for her as Hamlet's violence. The father, who put her in harm's way and failed to rescue her, holds her tight and comforts her, not allowing her to talk. Ophelia is emotionally rocked in every direction. As for the king, he completely ignores her and her pain, giving in to anger and brooding. His mood is not improved by Polonius's reiteration of his mad-for-love theory, and he furiously slams his hand against the wall. Polonius almost approaches fatherly kindness in this scene, putting his well-meaning but empty comforting of his daughter above playing the sycophant to the king's frustrations. When considering Olivier's adaptation, we must contend with the unusual placement of the sequence. It comes after the fishmonger scene through a time-lapse transition and sets up To Be or Not To Be, which becomes a guilty reaction to it. Gene Simmons' Ophelia is probably the most innocent Ophelia of them all. Almost a child, really, and as such can hardly lie convincingly. Throughout the scene, she keeps glancing at the heiress behind which her father and the king are hiding, usually before her cue to speak, leading Hamlet to do the same. He was suspicious when he came in, but Ophelia's jumpy disposition inflames his paranoia. Not that Hamlet doesn't give her cause to be jumpy. He throws her book away to stop her from reading, and his blasé, monotone, well, 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 doesn't let on that he cares for her.
Well, well, well.
When he doesn't receive the tokens she hands him, she uncomfortably puts them on the table, his cue to grab her hand violently. By violent, I merely mean sudden. All the violence in this scene is psychological. There are a few moments where Ophelia throws herself at Hamlet and he pushes her away and watches her fall, but that's about it. The performances, however, add a lot of sting to the words. When Hamlet tells her she should not have believed his love, she rubs her cheek as if she'd been slapped. And in a slight change to the accepted text, Ophelia cries out, "Help me, you sweet heavens," instead of "Help him." She's the one in distress, and who emotionally explodes, not Hamlet. His only violence is rejecting her or refusing to show kindness, and it's what sets her off. Polonius's claims of madness for love aren't so much wrong as they are targeted at the wrong person. If the mirroring effects of the play go in a like-parent-like-child direction, we must then recall how Polonius earlier claimed he suffered much for love. It's behavior genetically imposed on Ophelia, but we can't say the same for Hamlet and his absentee father. Hamlet's lack of interest in Ophelia is counterpointed by his over-interest in the heiress and what might wait beyond it. In moments, he is talking not to Ophelia, but directly to the heiress. The word ambitious, in particular, is directed at Polonius and the king. Should we infer that the litany of sins Hamlet accuses himself of, are actually leveled at them? Or is it an implicit threat to the throne? If it is, it's one that consciously confuses the issue of his motivation. The spies could understandably, if mistakenly, believe his motives to be political. By the end of the sequence, Ophelia is on the floor and Hamlet is conversing only with the two people who are ignoring her cries for help. He leaves her with a last kindness, kissing her hand and advising her to get out of Elsinore. Ophelia's speech is replaced by loud sobbing as the spies completely ignore her. Polonius follows the king around and only spares her a look very late in the game. And even then, he leaves her on the steps alone. As we leave the scene, Ophelia is reaching for Hamlet, or for her sanity, or in a more metatextual way for the camera's point of view, which may or may not be the ghost's. What does she see going up those steps? Is her mind breaking already? If it is the ghost and not a proper hallucination, does she recognize Hamlet in it? In any case, the pitiable image stresses how the entire scene has been about violating Ophelia. As usual, Derek Jacobi, in the BBC version of this scene, is full of surprises. When his Hamlet sees Lala Ward's Ophelia, he first puts his finger on his lips, as if to indicate that she shouldn't speak because he knows they're being spied on. But it's not clear. He then grabs her book and reveals she was reading it upside down. She winces, her ploy half discovered. And while we smile, Hamlet becomes hurtful, sarcastic, mocking. It is not without reproach in his voice that he says,
"In thy orisons be all my sins remembered."
And is there not a mirror of falsification here? She is pretending to read, to be lonely, etc., as much as he is feigning madness, which is to say consciously false, and yet working from a kernel of truth. Jacobi's reading turns the lines into an accusation or revelation that she is false. When she finally speaks, he treats it as a performance, laughs, and mockingly applauds. I've never found Lala Ward a very effective Ophelia. Though she sobs through the whole sequence, never are there tears. This obvious actor's artifice takes some of the punch away from Hamlet's mocking of those sobs. They're more like an actor mocking another. The re-delivered gifts are often papers, presumably Hamlet's poetry, but here they go another way, with a long green scarf. Hamlet grabs it from Ophelia's hands and uses it to snag her neck. Though further violence of that kind does not ensue. He does admit he loved her once, but by this point, she's scared. He refutes it almost immediately, of course, and when she says she was the more deceived, Hamlet reacts with a non-committal gesture, like, "Oh well, that's your problem, isn't it?" Things take a turn when he underlines his line about being a breeder of sinners by making a gesture towards her crotch. The embarrassment makes her look towards the heiress, and though Hamlet has no visible realization, just an odd look, he soon starts shouting his litany of sins at the wall and starts opening secret doors. It seems he didn't know all along, but he's not surprised. Obviously, Ophelia was playing some kind of game, but perhaps he didn't know the spies were so close. His breakdown comes unannounced after the lie about her father, and he cries through the next lines. He throws her to the ground, leaves, comes back again a number of times, slaps at the empty air in front of her, shakes her violently, and finally embraces her.
"It hath made me mad."
Now this line is here in Epiphany, a sudden evaluation of his actions and emotions. His tone is unusually apologetic when he says there will be no more marriages. His rage completely drained, even though there is the promise of revenge in his words. Patrick Stewart's Claudius is equally interesting in the aftermath. Instead of the usual anger, we get fear and foreboding. The quiet tone allows some of the lines to come across differently. For example, the line about sending Hamlet on a sea voyage to change his settled heart is better revealed as an image of moving the body to move the mind.
"To prevent, I have in quick determination set it down, he shall with speed to England for the demand of our neglected tribute. Haply, the seas and countries different with variable objects shall expel this something settled matter in his heart, whereon his brain, still beating, puts him from fashion of himself. What think you on?"
Perhaps by uprooting Hamlet from his madness, Claudius can move him away from whatever action he is planning. Ironically, what Claudius does not realize is that Hamlet's madness, in effect, is inaction, not action. By uprooting him from it, he ensures Hamlet will return moved to action. The Hamlet who returns from abroad is indeed determined, and part of the reason for it is the voyage. Specifically, he's meeting with Fortinbras's troops on the way, but perhaps also hanging out with pirates. Instead of ignoring Ophelia completely, as many Claudiuses do, this one isn't so cold and says the last line to her directly.
Madness in great ones must not unwatched go.
That final rhyme is now meant to reassure her, to perhaps cement her loyalty, that what they are doing is for Hamlet's own good. They must watch him to help him. This may in part explain why Ophelia never tells Hamlet that there are plans to spy on him in his mother's closet and so on, though Hamlet's erratic actions have as much to do with it. In his film, Zeffirelli splits the nunnery scene in two. The first part, just after Ophelia is tasked, but before To Be or Not to Be, and the second inserted in the ribaldry preceding the mousetrap, collapsing two of Ophelia's humiliations into the same moment in that case. In the first section, Mel Gibson's Hamlet initially tries to ignore Ophelia, walking away from her at a brisk pace, but she catches him up with remembrances. That word is well chosen, actually. Though Hamlet refuses to take the gift back, it's his memories of a happier time that she can't prevent from returning. And those memories are, in essence, missing, because Hamlet denies their existence. Gibson plays the moment with some measure of dumbfoundedness and self-imposed amnesia. Helena Bonham Carter's Ophelia is more aggressive than most, which is an interesting choice. She's the jilted one here, and she won't take his bull. Does she suspect he's only feigning madness? The visual creates irony, the tiniest of girls versus the action hero. That also exists in the power dynamic of the characters, in the court and in the play. This,
my honored lord, you know right well you did,
becomes an accusation. Hamlet laughs at her gesture. Did he perchance see the shadows of the spies playing on the wall? Ambiguous. He only goes off shouting at the room and at her after her lie that her father is home. The camera, trapped in Ophelia's point of view, spins round and round as Hamlet turns the tables and becomes the aggressor. At the end of his rant, which doesn't include the nunnery lines, notably, he runs up the stairs and throws down the just regifted remembrance. She timidly picks it up again in the background, the only reaction left from the text's short speech, as Claudius and Polonius come out of the woodwork to discuss what just happened. Hamlet stands in the doorway, hidden. This is how he knows about the trip to England, and of course, it's a confirmation of the plot against him. Nunnery-related lines are inserted during the play within a play's preliminaries, in a more private moment, after the more public humiliations of both Ophelia and Gertrude, after the line, half a year. Almost swooning, he starts with, "Get thee to a nunnery," which she finds strange and upsetting, and leaves off after, "Believe none of us," as the play starts. The intimate nature of the sequence takes away any ribald meaning from the word nunnery, and it becomes an imploration to save herself from both this tragedy and any future tragedy which comes with childbearing, in his view. She has no answer to give. In Hamlet 2000, Ophelia is wired by her father and heads for Hamlet's apartment. The transition to that scene is a wall of water, a fountain in Elsinore, water being Ophelia's symbolic element. She's brought Hamlet a somewhat psychedelic box filled to the brim with letters and other mementos, like a rubber ducky, again an image of water. The whole scene feels particularly modern and, in a sense, mundane. We recognize the ex-boyfriend-girlfriend dynamic here playing out in a familiar argument. She's reproachful of his attitude, and he plays the cold bastard with her. Cutting the lines about the paradox makes the dialogue more of this time as well. Hamlet's more ambiguous explanation of "Are you honest? Are you fair?" is the simpler,
"I did love you once."
Reducing, perhaps, the emotional equation to there being no beauty without honesty. Alternatively, he may be telling Ophelia he loved only her falsified image, and that he does not love the person she actually is under the surface. The scene really hinges on the line, "I love you not," after which Ophelia, for the first time, seems to feel emotion. Her usual attitude could be described as numb, or at least guarded. After these wounding words, we cut to a shot of a jet overhead, an image of something departing, or just a way to underscore a silent beat. And yet, Hamlet isn't without kindness. He seems comforting as he moves to her and rubs her shoulders, and his speech sounds like someone saying it's for the best. and justifying why the two of them shouldn't marry, lest they revisit the sins of their parents on their partners and children. It's one of the play's themes, isn't it? Hamlet's struggle is that having found his parents lacking, he fights to not become like them. One might even find enough evidence here to show that Claudius is Hamlet's biological father, as the prince actively resists the new king's romantic and murderous aspirations. Hamlet tries to leave Ophelia with some measure of kindness. Overwhelmed by emotion, she kisses him out of desperation, perhaps only now understanding that it's over between them. When he tells us to believe none of us, it may be a warning to keep her safe from the plots that are about to unfold. His madness, yes, but also the courtly schemes, and her father's, most of all. And as the scene gets hotter and heavier sexually, he suddenly finds the wire under her blouse. He's been trying to warn her about the conspirators in their midst, only to find that she's one of them. "Where is thy father?" is spoken with a hand over the microphone. But even under that muffled safety, she doesn't answer, because of course, he would be at home. This is a remote heiress. Hamlet shouts some of the next lines right into the wire, leaving no doubt that he's discovered it. Ophelia, caught, embarrassed, and upset, puts all her things in that box, rips off the wire, and packs it in two, and leaves in a rush. Most of the time, we don't see Hamlet in frame. This is her scene, her point of view, her pain. After a bike ride home, we see her burn Polaroids of Hamlet. Why, when the rest of the scene seems to tell us she's still in love with him? She probably thinks it's all her fault if it's over. It was looking as if they might get back together for a moment there, but then the wire was discovered. Foolish girl, allowing your father to use you against the man you love like that. Because Ophelia's story ends in a suicide, we know her to be self-destructive. And here she destroys the better part of herself, so to speak, as her answering machine picks up Hamlet's curses and nunnery talk.
If thou dost marry, I give thee this plague for thy dowry. Be thou as chaste as ice, as pure as snow, thou shalt not escape calumny. Get thee to a nunnery. Go. Farewell.
I say we shall have no more marriage! Those that are married already, all but one, shall live. The rest shall keep as they are. To a nunnery. Go.
It makes no more marriages something more intimate, something only she hears, since Claudius and Polonius cannot possibly overhear it. From kindness, Hamlet has moved to cruelty. There can be no ulterior motive for yelling this part of the speech at Ophelia, though one may easily presume Polonius taps her phone. And as she breaks down, we cut to Hamlet renting videos. He's moving on from the relationship and to a more active role in the play itself. In Fodor's more experimental Hamlet, this scene comes on the heels of the conspirators discussing their plans to spy on Hamlet while Ophelia boards him, even as they watch him practice fencing from behind a two-way mirror. Hamlet reclines on the floor, and they send Ophelia to him. She kisses him to wake him, and never really seems hurt at any point. This is an Ophelia that is controlled by her sister Polonia through drugs, and one that might well be just as manipulative as her sister. In no way does she appear to be as vulnerable as other Ophelias are, but her confidence may be bolstered by chemicals. In any case, the accidental image created by her hair connecting her mind with Hamlet's as they touch heads is merely illusion. There's no emotional understanding between them. The two-way mirror device is well used, allowing both Hamlet and Ophelia to look straight at Claudius and Polonia. The effect is different depending on the speaker. Hamlet's words are ironic because he doesn't know, at least initially, who he's really speaking to, while Ophelia can give meaningful looks to her co-conspirators. The image of that free-floating mirror creates an ironic wedding portrait. But while Ophelia remains rather cold, it's Polonia who reacts the most, giving weight to Hamlet's words. While Claudius shakes his head in disbelief, Polonia seems to feel the stings that Ophelia doesn't. This is a new side of her character. Normally, she's basically psychotic. But do we glimpse here empathy for her sister? Or is she as selfish as ever and seeing the stepfather in the sun? There's an obvious relationship between Claudius and Polonia in the film. But does he love her? And does she even care, seeing as she's manipulating him anyway? It's an effect created by the mirror and the regendering that we have two couples, one on each side of the glass. At least some of her reactions come down to embarrassment at being proven wrong about Hamlet's love-induced madness, and certainly Claudius reacts quite strongly at having his time wasted by this exercise. Is that loss of power over him what she's really reacting to? As the sound design becomes more and more bizarre, we get strange, anxious birds, and finally funereal bells, Hamlet seems to realize they might be watched. Having grown up in this house, he probably knows it's a two-way mirror. Ophelia doesn't answer him when he asks where her sister is, either because it would be absurd, the house is everyone's home, or as a continuation of her passive, numb attitude. He leaves and she's left standing there with no real reaction, and certainly no speech. On the other side of the mirror, Claudius also leaves, disagreeing with Polonius' take, though not resolving to send Hamlet to England here. We're left with two sisters, abandoned by their lovers, staring at each other. The 2009 adaptation starring David Tennant also uses a two-way mirror to hide, or rather to frequently cut to, the spies. Ophelia is steady at first, while Hamlet is visibly upset and keeps his distance from her. Confronting this part of his life is painful, and seeing him like this, Ophelia quickly starts to break down too. There's a nice hesitation from her on redeliver, as if looking for the right word.
I have remembrances of yours that I have longed to. Redeliver.
She draws attention to that choice. She's not giving back, she's redelivering. What, if any, and aside from being more poetic, are the meanings behind the word? One might infer here a more chaste relationship between Hamlet and Ophelia, a romance through correspondence, more than intimate contact. Gifts were delivered and now must be redelivered. Not that this adaptation means to paint the Hamlet-Ophelia relationship that way. Perhaps Ophelia is playing down their intimacy for her watching father. But Hamlet has been at university. How close is this relationship? The way Hamlet tries to keep her at a distance, batting and waving away her approaches, also gives a slightly different meaning to I never give you aught.
Not I never gave you aught.
It seems clear that he rather means he's not the same person who gave her those gifts. By accepting his father's mission, he erased all other things from his mind, or tried to. That's the central conflict of the play. He's already renounced Ophelia and love, but here they both are again, and he must reassert his new self and push away any and all distractions. New Hamlet cannot be involved with Ophelia, and even that history needs to be erased. Compared to how the memory of his father has likewise been excised from the court's memories. What Gertrude has done to Hamlet Sr., Hamlet Jr. is doing to Ophelia. She's not dead, but of course, the ghost is a living character too. So even when he grabs her, he seems to push her away, like he's defending himself from her touch and all the earthly concerns it represents. This push and pull is very much symbolic of Hamlet's attitude throughout the play. His goal goes against his values, and he hates the women he loves. You should not have believed me is spoken with hands on his head. The paradoxes of the play are making him crack. While the spies behind the mirror are quiet, the hyper-surveillance element in this adaptation does make a noise as our point of view shifts to that of the security camera zooming in. That's when he realizes it's a setup and gets angry at Ophelia, shouts at the air to make sure he's heard and recorded. Ophelia is not thrown to the ground. She gets down on her knees to pray. Hamlet's violence is only verbal, though he does rip the love letters up as if they were broken wedding vows, while she gestures ineffectually to try and save them. When he accuses women of nicknaming God's creatures, he holds up her Bible, which she was reading to color her loneliness. Given how quickly she falls to praying, it makes sense that this would be her book. But what does Hamlet's line mean? I've struggled with it. According to the Old Testament, Adam was given the task of naming all living things. Is Hamlet really condemning women for subverting God's wishes and in effect renaming the animals? It's an image of falsification, like the attack on cosmetics or love and sex games, and I now notice that it's something we get back to in Ophelia's madness scenes, where different flowers are given different names and meanings, and Gertrude does it too when talking about the suicide. If Shakespeare wasn't such a feminist in other plays, it would be easy to see a vicious misogynistic streak in this one. Women in Hamlet's world are not allowed to define or create their own world. And the naming of creatures and plants has a thematic relationship with Gertrude naming Claudius as her husband. Hamlet's revolt is against his world being shaken up by a woman. After he leaves, Ophelia sobs through her entire speech and drops to the mirrored floor. As in other mirror-based stagings like Branna's, the thing she sees and that haunts her is herself, that ugly thing she has become by participating in her father's schemes. In effect, she agrees with Hamlet's evaluation of himself as a monster created by women, and feels responsible for that transformation. However, he also told her not to believe a word he says. Was this a coded message she somehow missed? Part of the tragedy of these characters is that they do not understand one another. Ophelia should know Hamlet well enough to see through his act, read those coded warnings, and heed his advice to leave Elsinore. She doesn't. This may be a problem with the Polonius family in general. Polonius certainly doesn't understand why Hamlet does what he does, and Laertes will allow himself to be convinced to work against Hamlet by the play's villain and find he needs to repent in his last moment. Polonius, as usual uncomfortable with emotion, comes out of hiding and hands his daughter a handkerchief, and in his embarrassment stresses that he heard it all. That all seems to represent all manner of unpalatable things, which he doesn't want to rehash, examine, or understand.
Now, Ophelia, you need not tell us what Lord Hamlet said. We heard it all.
The structure of the play only now has Polonius board Hamlet as the prince runs back and Ophelia scurries away. It makes Polonius even thicker than normal. Pursuing a line of inquiry, Claudius is just rejected. The nunnery scene is not in the broadcast episodes of Slings and Arrows, but can be found as a deleted scene on the DVD. While the group is rehearsing outside, they coax Jack Crewe into using the text instead of his usual paraphrasing. A natural cut because it revealed too early that Jack knew the words and could do them, undercutting the later scene where his director forces him to do To Be or Not to Be with the text. His paraphrasing is pretty ridiculous at times. There is no reason not to use Shakespeare's original on lines like I loved you once, for example, since it already sounds modern. The one paraphrase that was interesting to me was the line about the paradox, translated as
beauty will turn a virgin into a slut before honor will turn a slut into a virgin.
This blunt interpretation paints Hamlet as someone who believes there's no coming back from sin. An honorable slut cannot recapture her virginity. Some things cannot be undone. Is he also talking about the revenge he must take? Is this part of his delay? Once a murderer, always a murderer? When he switches to the Shakespearean original, Jack proves he can not only do it, but do it well. And his choices are interesting, too. He puts a venomous emphasis on the word mother, for example, highlighting the fact that she's more germane to the discussion than Ophelia is.
I am myself indifferent, honest, but yet I could accuse me of such things that it were better my mother had not borne me.
He puts a manic spin on his ambitions, acts like a mischievous creature, makes Ophelia laugh. How would this have played in context, making Hamlet impish in this moment rather than cruel? Wouldn't have quite worked, not without excising Ophelia's implorations to heaven and her soliloquy. It might work within the framework of a more mercurial performance, where he turns to cruelty suddenly, or a production that, through cuts and inferences, made Ophelia more of a knowing ally to Hamlet. In any case, we don't find out because the sprinklers start going and Jack switches to King Lear's storm speech. While it does bring up the larger question of the way madness is portrayed in Shakespeare and draws a connection between the two characters and how in each play the protagonist's state of mind is projected onto the environment, it does abort a possible staging for the nunnery scene. Because Slings and Arrows takes inspiration from the plays in its greater story, it is a nice touch here that the festival administrator plotting against the production's success is Polonius-like watching the scene from his car. In A Midwinter's Dream, the play passes by very quickly, with clips from the most famous scenes, but they still yield some interesting and often amusing staging ideas. In this case, Ophelia follows There, my lord, with a throwing of the gifts and a powerful slap across Hamlet's face. There's an in-film, offstage motivation for this, of course. Nina, who plays Ophelia, and Joe, who plays Hamlet, had been exhibiting feelings for one another, and when Joe left to do a big movie in America on the night of the premiere, she felt betrayed. He comes back to do the play, but the betrayal still stands between them. Nina uses it, as they say, and makes her feelings Ophelia's. While there are some Ophelias, like Zeffirelli's, that play it cross more than sad, no other achieved this kind of passionate fury. I'd love to see if such a portrayal could be sustained in the full context of a production. On to comics, while the original Classics Illustrated adaptation sometimes feels like a boy's adventure, it does surprise the informed reader with a full page devoted to what is essentially a relationship scene. Though cut down for space, all the emotional beats are there, even Ophelia's often cut speech, or part of it at least. Hamlet doesn't get violent or even manic, and simply leaves a dejected Ophelia almost mid-sentence. When she prays for his sanity to be restored, it is in reaction to what, in this context, seems like a non sequitur. Devoid of the emotional context actors or a stronger cartoonist gives the scene, Ophelia can only conclude Hamlet is spouting nonsense and never understands those words to be about her. She feels the sting of his telling her he never loved her, nothing more. Not that he ever says this in this cut-down version. He merely tells her she should not have believed him. It's a very different thing. He loved her, but she should not have reciprocated, seeing as how things turned out. Claudius, behind the arras, may well conclude that love is not the cause of madness here, because Hamlet chose none. There's hardly any passion in the character. Tom Bandrake's adaptation in the Berkeley version is more sensitive. He allows Ophelia's reaction to play in close-up. Hamlet isn't violent, but he does tower over her, his hands placed in vaguely menacing places. It's an awkward drawing, but I believe it's Mandrake's native expressionism that distorts the figures for conscious effect. Ophelia's voice is almost swallowed up, her words get smaller as her spirit is smothered. The staging that sets this adaptation apart is that she runs off during Hamlet's curse. He's left behind shouting as she quickly goes, one might assume, to that nunnery. As she exits, a tapestry is revealed. Mandrake plays the heiress as a progressive reveal, in fact. First, Hamlet mentions Ophelia's father. Then, we see the heiress they said they were going to hide behind. In a third panel, they are in shadow. Claudius seems to uncover the fourth panel himself and shed light on the spies and their plans. On the album of Johnny Holiday's never-produced rock opera, the song Ophélie aux Folies comes rather early, and admittedly, it refers to the kissing carrion line from Hamlet and Polonius' encounter. However, the song also seems to reference the breeding of sinners, and in its title and ending, Ophelia's impending madness. So I've chosen to discuss it here, where all those ideas intersect.
Le soleil sans vergogne fait d'une peau vermeille une infecte charogne. Fuis devant le soleil.
Lost in translation here for non-French speakers is how Ophélie and Ophélie, Ophélie, sound alike, a trait or a fate built into the character in the song. In English, one might equate her name with Ophelia, and even if Shakespeare wasn't making a point with the name, its sonority might have a subliminal impact on the audience. Wordplay is a major part of the bard's style, so we can't completely dismiss it. The song, played as an almost dirge-like lamentation for the character, begins with the image of women as carrion and their children maggots, fathered by the sun, which is a common symbol for the male principle. He tells her to run away from the sun. In English, we might be tempted to play on sun in the sky and son of a father, but no such relationships exists in French. And that ties it to the nunnery scene in that way. The second movement of the song uses an angelic choir where the title is used to confuse the two terms, Ophélie and Ophélie, together, making them undifferentiated. As the tempo accelerates, we can feel Ophelia's mind spinning and careening as she dives into madness. Her whole story is here. On the album, we won't hear of her again until her death. And that ends our look at Act 3, Scene 1, Part 3. Next week, Scene 2 begins with Hamlet instructing the players. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope, dear listener, you'll return for Act 3, Scene 2, Part 1, Instructing the Players.
The rest is silence.